hungry for that feeling of being in love again since I was a little child. That free, open, blah. That when I felt it again, I wanted to possess it. Not unreasonable. You know, where will you be Thursday night? Where will you be Friday night? Where, you know, let's build a nest. Now I'm just, now it's not me anymore, I'm just playing with the storyline. So you build a nest, get straw and stuff and build a nest. And you're all really happy in the nest because each of you is the key that opens the other ones to the place in their heart where they are loved. You keep saying, I love you. No, you don't love me as much as I love you. No, I love you, and son, you go. Now it comes, everybody gets hungry, and so you go to the store for tofu and beer. And you're at the checkout counter, and you happen to look into the eyes of the person behind the checkout counter. And the same key is present. Do you see what I see? I mean, your mind works very fast then. Have you considered a ménage à trois? Because what you're feeling, weirdly enough, is you're in love with the second person the way you're in love with the first person, except that wasn't the nature of the contract or the game or dot, dot, dot. New problem. So you start to build communities. The Adamites were great models for that. But after a while, you just see that politically and socially, it's too damn complicated. To every time that door opens and you feel love, to collect it. Because you realize that once you have two or then three or maybe a half dozen, you don't have any time for anymore. You're just exhausted, just being around your beloved, who you collected. So you start to change the game a little bit because you realize you're not going to be, either you're going to stop collecting or stop looking. And you want to keep your eyes open to the world, so you say, I've got to stop collecting. So then you get so, well, there's a great stage where, do you see what I see? You know, let's have coffee together. And let's exchange names. What you're saying is, if I run out at home, there'll be another one out there waiting because I love being in love. I love it. I hope this isn't too, well, if it is. So be it. See, because as you do your spiritual practices or keep coming in or coming in or coming in and coming in to the deeper and deeper parts of your being, the boundaries between self and other keep dissolving, and you are suddenly in a sea of presence with other beings, which is, you are in a quality of intimacy of awareness that feels mightily like love. And since you've come out of a deprivation model, like a dry sponge, you've been trying to collect your lovers. And then you realize you have to change, so you just collect little fragments of them. And then you get to the point where you're walking down the street and you look at somebody. I remember I was on a bus on 3rd Avenue in New York at rush hour. And I was way back in, and a woman got on the bus, and boy, the woman had broken down shoes and the Daily News under her arm, and she was tired, and she had her bag of groceries, and she was going home. She was that feeling. And she started walking down the aisle, pushing her way through, and I looked in her eyes, and her eyes and mine caught. And she went through first, what do you want, my life or my money? That's like, because that's New York. And then I was just sitting there, you know, standing there, and her eyes opened, and there we were. I mean, there we were, and the whole bus was irrelevant, the whole thing. We were just standing there. We were in love, actually. But what were we going to do about it? I mean, there was really nothing much to do about it. She and I both realized that. And what I find more and more is I keep meeting the beloved and there's nothing to do about it. See, at first you can go around and say, are you experiencing what I'm experiencing? Wow, that's the next level. So you go from building a nest to taking their number to just reassuring yourself that they're experiencing it, to getting to the point where you are just resting in this quality of seeing the beloved in all the forms. And then every time you don't see the beloved, you realize you don't because something in them awakened in you some part of your judgmental mind that's coming out of your own fear. So what I love is taking people who are not my beloved. I mean, it's easy to work with my cat, you know. But to look at somebody that is not my beloved and then just watch my heart open and just keep working with it, and seeing the beauty. Like when I had Caspar Weinberger on my puja table, it wasn't, I mean, I have nothing against Caspar Weinberger as a human being. I have a lot against the actions that Caspar Weinberger's role caught him in. And I saw that as heavy karma for soul. And I was trying to find the soul in there rather than identifying him only with his actions. Like when somebody says, are there evil people? I think there are actions which increase suffering. And I think some people are caught so deeply in a web of karma that that's all they do is create actions that create suffering, and one is inclined to say they are evil. But actually that just keeps reinforcing the identity of that soul with their actions, which prevents them from changing. Like you're a bad boy. See, I think that the millennium on one level is just this funny game of the mind to create a date that's significant and then imbue it. So this will be the important time for everybody. It's like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. But in my aging wisdom, I have a sense of the incredible beauty of the unfolding design of the universe. I really treasure it. I treasure the mystery of it. I really delight in the mystery of it. And as I start being busy pushing it away and just be in it, I feel myself falling into whatever my part is in the whole process of moving towards the millennium or being whatever that is. And let's say the millennium was my moment of death. How would I want to prepare for my moment of death? Since I don't know what happens after death, you may, but I don't. I have a deep sense from all of the stuff that has come at me and from whatever experiences I've had that there is much more than what we see, think, smell, and taste about it all. In other words, I am absolutely comfortable that there is a larger context or a larger frame on the painting than the one bounded by our life and death. But I'm equally comfortable because of the amount of acid I've taken to consider the possibility that what comes after death is non-conceptual. And that all of the myths from all the different traditions, whether it's the Tibetan Book of the Dead or the Native Americans or the Christians or the Jews or the Islamic group or the Zoroastrians, the Egyptians, whoever said what about after death is basically had an experience which is non-conceptual, and then in coming back to report it, took on a conceptual framework that was as close to it as they could get. It was the fingers pointing to the moon, it was not the moon. So what I experienced since the few times that I have been privileged to go to the edge of my mind and leave thought behind and rest in awareness and, in a sense, die as even a concept of self. I see that at the moment of death, I see that as entering a mystery. That's all I can say. I'm entering a mystery. And the interesting question I then ask myself is, how do you enter a mystery? There used to be a radio show, as some of us may remember, I Love a Mystery. I love a mystery. Well, it's interesting because most of us say, well, little changes are great. They keep life spicy. But I don't want the big changes. See, I've worked with so many people that are dying, and what I notice is that as they're approaching death, their consciousness is shifting. They're like turning their heads in a different direction. It's like in India, when somebody dies, they put them on the on a stretcher and cover them with cloth and carry them through the street to the burning ghat, the body. It's there under the cloth. And halfway to the burning ghat, they stop and they turn the stretcher around so that the head is now towards the burning ghat instead of the home. And that's exactly what I experience happening when people are dying. That if there is this process, that when the support is right and the conditions are optimum, often what's happening is they can, quite intentionally, they start to turn their consciousness. The meaning of their children or grandchildren or pictures or all starts to fall away, and they open to a deeper part of their being or another place or another reality. And when that happens, most people that are surrounding a dying person misinterpret that. And they say the person's losing their mind, not talking sense. I mean, when my dad was getting close to his dying the last year or so, he became very, very silent, and he just smiled. And we'd hold hands, which we never did. Never. And at one point, a man came to visit my father who hadn't gotten along with him very well, and he said, "Hi, how you doing?" And my father just smiled at him. And the guy went out of the room, and he said to me later, "That bastard, he still won't speak to me." And then my aunt came to visit, and she loved my father. He was her elder brother. "George, how are you doing?" And he just smiled at her. And she said, "Oh, George, what have they done to you? Where have they taken you?" You can hear her pain. All he was doing was smiling. I mean, massaging him was like rubbing the Buddha. And I could feel the turning of his consciousness. And when you don't say, "Come on back, hey, are you there?" There's a great film called Chronicle or Confessions, no, of a Dutiful Daughter. It's a film put out by the Alzheimer's Society. Superb about Alzheimer's. I mean, those of you that have been in and out of this plane of consciousness realize it's nice. But when you go somewhere else, it's nice too. And you don't get so upset about it. I mean, very often my work when I go to see a person is just to listen my way into where their consciousness is. Not to judge it. Why is it any worse or better than mine? To be with them. So I am trying to learn to live with the beloved. And the beloved is the earth. And the beloved is all the species and all the things that dwell thereon and in. And for me to see the beloved everywhere I look requires that I be the beloved. You can't have it the other way. You can't hold on to your self deprecation and really see the beloved. This is really interesting. I mean, it took me so many years till I could finally just say, you know, I am. Just the way I am, I am. Not with, if only I, then I would be. Just I am. I am. For a while I tried, I am beautiful. And I am beautiful. But I saw that any label was a problem. I just soon stay with I am. I am. And I do crummy things and I do beautiful things. And I get clear and I get confused, but I am. And you are, and here we are. And what's interesting is when you become an instrument to allow other people to see their own reflection through you. You're not doing it to them. You are merely creating a reflection of a place in them which they can't get to, usually by themselves, easily. So when I look at somebody and see the beloved, what does it feel like for them to be loved that way? Because how do you love the beloved? And what blows my mind is sometimes when I'm really quiet inside and this quality of feeling is just present, it's like walking through a flower garden and everywhere you look, a flower blooms. It just blows your mind. See, I was so busy saying there's nobody here. Oh. Suddenly everybody was here. And then I realized it was my model of who was here that was here or not here. You've got to see, if you keep examining your own mind, which is must be your work in part, to become mindful, you must see that who you think you are is creating, and how you think it is what's creating the reality of what you're seeing. I mean, if three of us are going through a town, and one of us is hungry, and one of us is horny, and one of us is driving and hears mechanical problems in the engine, at the other end of town, if we take a sampling of who saw what in the town, one person saw the restaurants, one person saw who was standing under the clock, and one person saw the garage that said repairs. Because desires affect perception. We all know that. That's commonplace now in psychology. Well, that's why the statement, truth waits for eyes unclouded by longing. When you desire things, you only see the outward container. So if I want something from you, when I look at you, all I see is that of you which can give me what I want. In other words, my identification with my desire makes you an object in relation to the gratification of that desire. So if I'm hungry and you're not edible, you're irrelevant. And if I get hungry enough, you may become relevant, as we have learned in our history books. And once you see the way you don't even know what's out there because you're too busy wanting things, and the wanting isn't the issue, it's the identification of yourself with the wanting to say, I want. Versus there is desire. And awareness is present independent of the desire. That awareness that's independent now has a chance to see what is. That's part of what the awakening is about. So you end up saying, well, what will I offer to the moment of my death? I would like to be not caught in my desire systems so that I could be open to the mystery freshly and just be with whatever is. Why come in with models of it? I don't want beliefs. Beliefs aren't going to keep me warm when my mind is disintegrating. I want to come in from a deeper place of my being. And because I find mysteries have always been an adventure is great. I kind of like it as long as it's within reason. I hope it's a little adventurous. And I have a kind of rascality in me, so I hope it's playful. Now, what I'm doing is I am preparing myself to enter my moment of death in such a way that I'm neither pushing the past away, grabbing the future, pushing the future away, grabbing the past. It's just another moment of, The lines in Tibetan Buddhism Dzogchen practice that say, prolong, it's five lines, prolong not the past, invite not the future. Do not alter your innate wakefulness. It's resting on you. Do not fear appearances. Whatever arises, just it arises. There is nothing more than that, the fifth line. Very simple. To be at that moment where you are a free, creative, present, non-conceptually, just rightly ready. See, we can all sit and watch the evening news to find out what the millennium was about. Or we can recognize that we are the millennium, that we are the consciousness that defines the reality that we are moving into and through, and what time is. So to me, the millennium is an inside job. That as you become resting in a delight in adventure, in presence, in non-grabbing, in not having models where you manipulate everything, in dealing with your fear, in just being present in the moment, you are bringing the optimum human being can bring to the hope or the possibility that the millennium can be the flowering of all humanity, because you see the next step as the beloved. Some questions, and then we'll talk some more. Yeah. I think the 12-step programs have been a remarkable grassroots phenomenon that has been incredibly beneficial to tens of, probably millions of people. And it has definitely brought a spiritual dimension to many, many people's lives. If I have one problem about the 12-step program, it is the inability to graduate. That would be my one limit. Because I think any definition of oneself, even as I'm an alcoholic, I mean, I have gout, so I take some medication for my gout. I don't go around thinking of myself as a goutee. And it's sort of that kind of issue that we're talking about here. But otherwise, I think AA has done incredibly wonderful stuff. Yes? You use images like it's the candle in the niche in the wall that when the wind blows, the candle doesn't flicker. It's a certain equanimity that pervades your being independent of changing fortune. The farmer who has a horse and the horse runs away. And his neighbor said, "That's really too bad." And the farmer says, "You never know." And the next day, the horse comes back and it's leading behind it a beautiful wild stallion. And the neighbor says, "What good fortune." And the farmer says, "You never know." Farmer's son was very attracted to the stallion and started to train it for a saddle. And in the course of the training, the horse threw the boy and the boy broke his arm. The neighbor happened to be passing by, said, "Oh, that's too bad." To which the farmer replied, "You never know." Shortly thereafter, the army was on a march through town, picking up all the young people and inscripting them into the army. But because the son had a broken arm, they passed him by. The neighbor surprisingly said, "What good fortune." To which the farmer said, "See, that's the quality of equanimity. Not a cynical, not stoicism. That has a little stoic quality to it. But I like the quality of just being present. Ah, so. Ah, so. Your house was just destroyed. Ah, so. The stock market just fell apart. Just after it hit 7,000. Ah, so. I'm sorry to report you have a malignant disease and you probably have a few weeks left to live. Ah, so. You hear what non-attachment feels like? Yeah. But I just met the person of my dreams and we are going to be so happy together. Ah, so. Ah, so. And the ah, so, at first I was afraid that the ah, so would take away the fun of life, would take away the passions of it, the stuff that makes As the World Turns such a perennial thing. Because what had happened was I had been so afraid of my passions that I pushed them away in order to be an ah, so. But it's kind of a cold, dead place all by itself. Somebody falls down and you say, ah, so, karma. You know, somebody comes up that's the most attractive being you've ever seen and wants to be close to you and you go, ah, so. You feel somehow you're losing it, something. And I saw that I was pushing stuff away in order to hold on to the ah, so, and that it was an imbalance. And so very gingerly, I started to let myself back into the world of broken hearts and of passions and hopes and fears and doubts and all of the stuff, the humanity of it all. And what I found...